Do I need headphones or anything?
No,
or
you sound we, or... you sound perfect. So, well, Tom, again, thank you so much for giving me this time. And I've been, I read Rubicon a number of years ago, and found it interesting. I, as someone with a divinity degree, I obviously had some background in Greek and Hebrew and classics. And I really enjoyed the nature or the style of that book. Was that your first book or your first book to really hit it big?
That was my first work of history. Previously, I'd been a novelist, but it took me time to work out that actually the real wellsprings of what I wanted to write about lay in childhood and youthful obsessions. So it can take time if you have a writing career to work out exactly what furrow you should be ploughing. And so I just realized, actually, you know what, the Romans are my great interest. I'm going to write about that.
So did you get your degree? Were you intending to be a fiction writer? Was that your goal initially?
Yeah, my great love initially was Greece and Rome, and then history generally, and did classical languages at school, studied them. Well, actually, not I just Latin, not Greek. So I didn't get to do Greek. So I did Greek later, but did Latin, and then discovered literature, and I was kind of triangulated, pulled three ways, couldn't decide what I wanted to do. So by the time I was 17, as when I was 17, I decided that I wanted to be a great novelist. So when I went to university, I focused very much on literature, but the interest in history and particularly the classical world was kind of bundled into that. So the very first thing I did, I wrote a novel about Catullus that was set in a kind of a Rome that was a contemporary city. And it wasn't quite the great work of fiction that I'd been hoping it would be. And simultaneously, to try and make money, I was doing a doctorate on Byron and his relationship to ancient Greek literature. And this was at a time when Interview with the Vampire, I think the only film in which Tom Cruise was blonde, appeared. And Byron was the original model for a vampire. So I knocked off this kind of book in which Lord Byron literally was a vampire, and got a publishing deal in England, got a publishing deal in America, got a kind of three book thing. And this was kind of untold riches. So although it had never been part of my life plan, I found myself writing three more vampire books, all set in historical periods. And the amount of research I did to demonstrate that there'd been a vampire in London in 1888 and in kind of 16th century Prague and then in ancient Egypt was absolutely enormous. And I realized that actually the reality of history is infinitely more interesting than having to kind of spice it up with supernatural garnishings. So after I did a novel about that featured Howard Carter discovering Tutankhamun, and then there was a Fatimid caliph, the Muslim Caligula as he was known, and then Akhenaten and Tutankhamun. I so much more enjoyed the research than I did the actual writing. I thought, you know, this is ridiculous. I want to write about the period of history that is my favorite period by miles. And so that's then how I began writing history. So it was a kind of roundabout way. But all the time, what's interested me is the kind of the intersection between history and literature. And I think that is why I was particularly drawn to the classical world, because most of the sources for ancient history have been shaped by literary artistry. So there's a sense in which doing ancient history often is a kind of literary criticism. And there's obviously something very similar in studying, first Islam, which is what I came to, and then Christianity. And I think particularly with Christianity, because the conclusion I've come to is that more than anything, it writes stories. It conveys its truths through narratives. And in a sense, you know, one of the ways of thinking about Jesus is that he's the greatest short story teller of all time. No one's short stories have had a greater impact, are more enigmatic, are more elusive, continue to reverberate into the politics and the society of the contemporary. But also, of course, just generally the biblical narratives. I mean, the narrative of Exodus, its impact on history is transcendent. Wherever you look in the records of Christian history, you see the trace elements, the furrows of Exodus. And then, of course, the most potent story of all, which is the story of the Passion and the Resurrection. That's always been my interest, the way that these ancient stories continue to reverberate and to replicate through into the present. And with Christianity, I've come to the realization it's actually even more successful at doing that than the Greeks or the Romans.
So what did you write after Rubicon?
After Rubicon, I then turned to the other great period of history, which was my love, which was the Persian invasions of Greece. Okay. And I loved them from a child because it was kind of Lord of the Rings, only true. Yeah. You know, an evil empire in the East invading the West, being seen off against all the odds. Unbelievable clashes, great tales of heroism, Marathon, Thermopylae, Salamis. You know, immense drama. But the real excitement of writing that book called Persian Fire was discovering that my childhood understanding of it had been pretty much bogus, and that at Thermopylae, really, it wasn't the Spartans who were on the side of freedom. I mean, neither were the Persians, really. But the Spartans were brutal slave owners, and my childhood romanticization of them had been naive, to put it mildly. So, and what that left me with was a deep sense of respect for the achievements of Persian civilization, and a sense that whereas Greek civilization kind of glows in our mind, like, you know, the blaze of the Parthenon, you know, etched against the blue sky, we can see it very clearly. With Persia, the influence is much more occluded. It's kind of underground, but it's just as deep. And one of the things that it was evident Persia had influenced not just the Near East, but Europe, and then by extension, the Western world generally, was this idea that the world could be a theater for moral engagement, that it was a place where good and evil clashed, where light and dark, truth and the lie met. And that, of course, is an idea profoundly influential on Christianity and Islam. And I remember there was one of the problems, obviously, with writing about Persia as opposed to Greece, is that the Greeks wrote, you know, invented history. Herodotus, the first great historian, who I then went on to translate, it's his account that basically we depend upon for the story of the Persian Wars. But the Persians aren't writing stuff. And really, there's only one exception that proves the rule. And this is a great series of inscriptions put up by Darius the Great, who comes to power in a coup and predictably claims that he is the defender of the truth, even though it's patently clear that pretty much everything he's saying is a massive lie. But in that inscription, there's a really intriguing little short passage where he says that he is fighting a people called the Elamites, and they keep rising up against him. And in the end, he condemns them because they do not worship Ahura Mazda, the god that Darius worships. And he tells the soldiers, his soldiers who are going to fight the Elamites, that if they die, they will go to heaven. So it's the very, very earliest glimmering of the kind of doctrine of jihad and crusade that will come later. But it's also intriguing because at the time, the notion that you might get into trouble for not worshipping somebody else's gods was a wholly bizarre one. So this is a really kind of fascinating glimmering. And I just thought, well, that's really interesting. That's something that I hadn't suspected. So that then kind of opened my eyes to, you know, all kinds of kind of fascinating highways opening up before me, which led me to write first the book about Islam and then this book, Dominion, about Christianity.
One of the things, so I got my undergraduate degree in history, and, you know, you begin by reading about history in a sense, and then you begin to dive into primary sources. And one of the things that you begin to notice is that the authors of these primary sources do not see the world the same way that we do. And while your books, I love, a couple of years ago, I think the author's name is Hampton Sides, Blood and Thunder, The Story of Kit Carson, which is a tremendously fun book on the American frontier. And, you know, so there, these blood and thunders during the frontier days were going out about cowboys and Indians, and people out east would love to read them for all the drama. So Persian Fire was full of that drama. But I very much enjoyed the book because along the way, you were sort of dropping little breadcrumbs about the fact that you were taking the religion of these people seriously. And not just as sort of a Westerner, these are ancient people who are, you know, believing crazy things, blah, 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 blah. What really matters is who dies by the sword. But you were noting their motivation in terms of their worldview. And then by virtue of the way you're writing, that's sort of slipping, I think, into people's imaginary.
I was doing my best to do that. So I tried to take the worship of Ahura Mazda by the Persian kings very seriously. And then conversely, I tried to take the relationship of the Greeks to their gods very seriously. And of course, one of the great ways in which the Greeks and the Persians are parallel lines is that for the Persians, truth is everything. Whereas for the Greeks, Apollo is a liar. That's the whole point. And Odysseus, the great hero of Greek epic, is a liar and a trickster.
Yes.
And you can see how, you know, really there's no intersection point on the Venn diagram there at all. But equally, the challenge is that I don't think that we can really get back to what you might call the truth, the reality of it. There's a kind of inherently fictional quality because, you know, our earliest sources really are so distant that we can't really trust them. So if you look at Thermopylae, the famous account of the battle, this is, in the book, I tell it as though it's actually happening, and I try to square it as best as I possibly can with what we know about the tactics and the armor and the terrain. I kind of walked the terrain of the battlefield and all kinds of things like that. But the haunting truth is that in Herodotus's account, he, for instance, describes Leonidas, the Spartan king, dying, being killed, and then the Persians and the Greeks fighting over his body. Now, that may have happened, but how do we know about it? The Spartans all die. I mean, that's the whole point of the story. you know, there are some Thebans who get taken prisoner, so maybe they saw it. I mean, we don't really know. But what we do know is that in the Iliad, the heroes die, and this is a battle being fought between East and West, and it's pretty clear that Herodotus is drawing on it. That doesn't mean that he's lying, but it means that he's drawing on traditions to give a kind of colour to this narrative in a way that means that in a kind of documentary contemporary sense, trying to get back to the truth effectively is impossible. And it's really interesting that you raise the example of the Wild West, because I think that's possibly the closest analogy. The whole point of the Wild West is that it is a kind of fiction that grows out of the soil of truth. You know, there is a frontier. There are these people. There are cowboys. There are Indians. There are shoot-ups. But the moment the frontier is closed, it's being fictionalized, first in novels and then in films. And in a sense, that tradition is constantly looking back, not so much to the actual history, but to the fictionalization, the mythologization of that history. And that, I think, is basically what we have again and again with ancient history. And you can try and get back as far as you can to the original point of time. But I think unless you acknowledge the inherently mythic, the inherently fictional quality of it, you're kind of missing something. You are too 21st century. So I basically try and have it both ways. I try and write it as history, and I try and write it as an acknowledgement that it ultimately cannot be history in the way that we understand it. The mythic quality of it is a necessary part of it. So you can see why that would then make me very interested in Christian history, because I think something similar is happening there. But to a profounder degree, in a much kind of more influential manner.
Well, you're hitting on all of the, you know, we're sort of on a hinge outside of modernism. You can't leave modernism alone. It matters what the autopsy would reveal on the bodies of the Spartans at Thermopylae. I mean, that layer matters, but the other layer is in many ways also colonizes the first layer and is vitally important for who we are and how we see the world. And again, I think that comes through the book. I read Dominion, and then I thought, oh, I got to read, you know, I'd read Rubicon a number of years ago, but it sort of passed from my memory. And then I don't remember how I heard about Dominion, but I read Dominion, and then I read Persian Fire. And right at the beginning of Persian Fire, you were talking about Herodotus, and I was trying to pull it up quick a minute, this quote about the fact that the something to the effect of the, you know, the Persians didn't write history. And I thought, what does that say? What does that say about how they viewed the world, as opposed to necessarily, you know, the Greeks who invent with Herodotus, they invent history?
Well, it means that the Persians think that all is for the best, because they've created their empire, and this reflects the eternal order of truth and light, and therefore it can't really be improved upon. And so therefore the role of the king is not to be an individual, but to play the part of the king. And in that sense, the only kings who really matter are Darius, who renews the empire, and then Cyrus, who founds it. And in that light, I think it's really fascinating that the two ancient peoples who clearly have the greatest influence on what will become Western history, the Greeks and the Jews, both idolize Cyrus. They both think Cyrus is great. Xenophon writes a whole kind of biography of him that's a massive love letter. And in Deutero-Isaiah, Cyrus is hailed as the Messiah.
Startling.
Yeah, that's quite an encomium. And so what we know about Cyrus derives basically from the Greeks and the Jews, both of whom were conquered by him. So you get a hint there as to the potency of the royal propaganda that he's promoting. And I think that you get a sense there of how potent this imperial propaganda can be, and how influential it is, and how the notion of a world divided into rival spheres of good and evil, in which the king is the agent of the good, is obviously an idea so effective that even people who've been its victims can buy into it. And that again is something that will reverberate through subsequent centuries and millennia.
So then after I read Persian Fire, then I got into In the Shadow of the Sword, which I found to be a powerful book, and obviously a book that stirred up quite a bit of controversy. And I think it's a really helpful book to read in conjunction with Dominion. One of the things that echoes, I mean, in that book, you're clearly dealing with the question of history in terms of, again, what the autopsy would reveal on such and such body versus the mythos that needs to play a role for the construction of civilizations, for empires, for people in the sort of Durkheimian sense that there needs to be something around which a people can form and mobilize, and that mobilization is absolutely integral to what will, you know, what empires are made of. In many ways, you know, I love the way that you began this conversation, because one of the things in our sort of postmodern sense, pastors have been relocated because you said we can't really trust. Well, there's a lot of can't really trust going on in terms of people's reading of the Bible and questions. The Bible obviously has been subjected to a great deal of scrutiny over the last couple of hundred years in terms of, okay, how do events and our perception and then stories of events, how do these things match up? And what does that mean for how we move forward? And so in many ways, pastors have become curators of stories for people. Now, when you get to the rise of Islam and the questions of their founding, I'll use the word in its generic sense, the surrounding mythos of Islam, well, these issues come to the fore, especially as I read through that book with a careful reading about the question of God, because you begin that book noting Eusebius, how by the time Eusebius rolls in and begins to write Christian history, well, it clearly was God's will that the Christians would triumph over Rome, and, you know, this remarkable turn of events where a crucified Jesus would now in some ways be seen as threatening the power of the Roman Empire. That script gets turned again with the rise of Islam. And so One of the things that you begin to notice when I, for example, would be studying something like the Book of Daniel, Daniel has all of these ordeals that play out. There's the fiery furnace with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. There's the lion's den. There's the king's table. You've got all of these ordeals playing out. Ordeals are very much premised on outcomes are determined by the god or the gods, and the gods reveal themselves in outcomes. And this obviously works at a very interesting angle with Christianity, because the whole premise of your savior is crucified just sort of comes to clash with this. So before we get into dominion, what did you learn about the ancients and their gods with respect to what gods are and how they reveal themselves?
That they're very various.
Yeah.
So again, looking back at the tension between Ahura Mazda and Apollo, you know, they're expressions of fundamentally different ways of seeing the world. And in a sense, in late antiquity, a world when you get, on the model of the original Persian Empire, you get these great sprawling empires that claim to be universal. What you get from them is a kind of desire for gods that are universal. And so over the course of late antiquity, you get gods that become more and more powerful. And that's evident in the way that the Roman emperors, basically throughout the third century, from the moment that the emperor Caracalla decrees that every free male in the Roman Empire will be a citizen, and so everyone basically becomes a Roman, the way in which there had previously been individual cults, individual ways of worshipping these gods becomes unsustainable, because you need one god for one empire, one civic identity. And so over the course of the third century, you have emperors who are basically auditioning a variety of gods for this role, whether it's Serapis or Sol Invictus or Apollo or Heracles or whatever. And of course, the god who finally passes the audition is the Christian god. But equally, the very fact that the Christian god has submitted himself twice to covenants, first on Mount Sinai, and then in whatever way you want to explain the new covenant, there is this sense that just as Christ has physically been nailed and bound to the cross, so the new covenant has kind of committed the Christian God to a kind of specific relationship to his people. This comes to be seen as a kind of unacceptable infringement on the totality of divine power. And the Muslim God is terrifyingly more powerful than the Christian God, really. He does not commit himself. He does not bind himself to covenants. He can do literally anything that he wants. And the result is that in the Quran, the power of God, the God of the Quran, is so immense that almost it's hard to know what to do with it. And whoever can lay claim to it really has kind of limit. There's the potential for what can be done with this power is potentially limitless. And so Islamic history becomes a kind of contest between the figure of the caliph and the figure of the ulama, the scholars and the lawyers who attempt to control this power. And it's so powerful that in a sense, a lot of the differences between what become Islamic and Christian civilization can be explained by that. The way in which, say, in Christian civilization, you have a God who, because he's bound by covenant, therefore it makes sense to think of the universe as being governed by laws that he has prescribed, in which he is content for the universe to obey. Whereas in the Islamic understanding of God, that's an infringement of his power. And so therefore, you know, every time a stone gets dropped from a building, the reason it drops isn't because there is some law that explains why it drops. It drops because God intervenes to make sure that it drops. And so that's why you have Newton in the Christian world, but you don't have his equivalent in the Islamic world.
That's I don't think I've ever heard that differentiation in that way. Because, you know, if you zip all the way over, oh gosh, there's so much history here. Well, let's go back perhaps to the Hebrews and the Babylonians and the Persians, because, you know, part of what happens in the ancient world, again, I've been reading this very interesting Jewish scholar. I don't know if you've read anything of him. I hadn't heard about him until just a few months ago.
I confess I haven't.
He makes the observation that there really have been fundamentally two systems going on through history. One was kind of the common system in which all of the gods emerge from what he calls a metadivine realm, out of which, you know, they emerge, and then the gods procreate, create this and that, and gods and demigods, and all sort of filters down. But what's fundamental is that there's a metadivine realm which has within it the laws to which the gods must somehow obey or hold themselves. It becomes the arena in which the gods work. His assertion is that the radicality of the Hebrew God is that in many ways, God is in effect the metadivine realm, but the God is personal. And I haven't read far enough in his book to notice this, but one of the things that I noted when I was, for example, going through the book of Ezekiel carefully was the transition that happens when, for example, the Babylonians come and destroy the temple of the Hebrews. The normal script would have been that Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews, had been destroyed by Marduk and the God of Babylon. And so you have this playing out of gods, and the Hebrews would do the Jews would do the rational thing, which would be to simply submit to the gods of the Babylonians and assimilate into their world, and the ancient Near East would have gone on. Instead, the Hebrews have this idea that somehow their God, and you know, Marduk doesn't even get a mention in the scriptures, their God somehow has engineered this whole event, and you don't see any mythology of gods battling or any of this stuff that we'd find much, much further on, but that this somehow is the is the manifestation of this one God, and he was to punish his people, and they themselves ought to hold themselves to the covenant, and so on and so forth. And again, what this produces is a similarly very large God under which all of this other drama happens, as opposed to a realm, an impersonal realm, in which these gods are always contending with one another in order to achieve supremacy and the particular goals that they desire. I noted in Persian Fire, there seemed to be hints within the Persians of something similar to what we perhaps find in the Hebrews, where you have the truth and the lie, and the emperor of Persia takes it upon himself to, you know, to dispel the lie and bring the truth in a universal sense. And your point here of the division of the God of the Hebrews covenanting himself to people in a faithful way is really fascinating, because it obviously is in Scripture, but the observation that in Islam such a God need not, as an emperor in a sense, cannot be held to his word by those beneath him. But we find, for example, in the book of Genesis with this incredibly fascinating passage where the Lord comes to tell Abraham what he's about to do in the city where Abraham's nephew is holding, and Abraham goes to dicker with the Lord, but dares not go down all the way to Lot. And in fact, there's a very interesting textual question in that passage as to whether or not the Lord is standing before Abraham or Abraham is standing before the Lord. So, you know, the question of these gods and their relationship to one another and the relationship to the cosmos itself is really at play here. And then, of course, we'll get mixed into this great drama that will take place within Christianity between these worlds. I don't know if that makes any sense.
I think that on the topic of gods binding themselves to covenants, there's a kind of prefiguring of the crucifixion in God's relationship to Moses, because what happens in antiquity is that gods are summoned as witnesses to covenants between different peoples. And so you summon, you know, if you're an Egyptian signing a treaty with the Hittites, both people will summon their gods to serve as witnesses. And there's enough commonality between these kingdoms and their understanding of the divine to ensure that both can accept their respective gods as the witnesses. The strange thing about the God of Israel is that he submits himself to a covenant. So there's a sense in which he is simultaneously, he's the only God, you know, he's the only one who can serve as a witness, but he is also subjecting himself to that. And I always wonder, when Paul had his vision, whatever it was, whatever he saw, and he must have gone and had a period of thought, what is going on here? What has happened? Whether this is what drew his attention, the idea that the very act of signing a covenant was in a way a kind of binding, and that the new covenant and the original covenant, both of them required a form of humility from God that is the counterpoint to his omnipotence. And that seems to be a tension that runs throughout the Old Testament as well as through the New. But I absolutely hasten to add that I am aware that in discussions of the Old Testament, that this is a vast continent, which I have very few maps and which I've kind of only scratched the surface of. So I wouldn't in any way want to pontificate about the Old Testament studies, which I know is essentially a field that requires a lifetime of study. My lifetime I have not devoted to studying the Old Testament.
The strange thing, of course, with the Hebrew God is there is no higher court. I mean, gods come and bear witness to the cutting of a covenant. There is no higher court. And I think it was in Dominion that, you know, there's this strange there's the strange reality of the fates. And I'm trying to think if it was in Dominion in your book, where there's this tension between the fates, which seem to be in some ways, you know, the highest court, and the gods, because even the gods are held to
the Greeks, yes.
The judgment of the fates. And so it's interesting watching those civilizations work with these tensions in terms of their metaphysical systems, and how that then, of course, then you've got this Hebrew God comes onto the field in a book with really no mythology as such. The kinds of mythologies we find in terms of the origin of the gods and the lives and deaths of the gods, so on and so forth.
I mean, you may disagree with me on this, and I'm aware that this is a controversial field, but it does seem likely to me there are kind of trace elements of a mythological dimension in the Old Testament that seems to have been edited out. So there do seem to be trace elements of this kind of idea of the great god fighting with a sea serpent, fighting with a sea monster, which is kind of, you know, there in right. Job and how, you know, have you managed to hook Leviathan and all that kind of thing. Yeah. So also that extraordinary psalm where God condemns the other gods because they have not cared for the poor or the weak or whatever, and sends them hurtling down. And that seems to, that does seem to me that you can that actually the Old Testament bears witness to a process of discovery on the part of the people who come to enshrine these texts as scripture. And that doesn't seem to me actually an imponderable challenge to belief, that to the, it seems to me perfectly possible to acknowledge that this is the process by which this happened. And in fact, it becomes rather a kind of powerful witness to the way in which, over the course of the centuries, the Jewish prophets and the Jewish people kind of awoke to a full understanding of what it was that they were dealing with, if one wants to deal it on a theological level. But on a purely historical level, I think that the emergence of this one God, I think, is part a historical process in which I think the translation of the Judean elite to Babylon, and then the conquest of Babylon by the Persians, and the influence of Persian understandings of the divine and of good and evil, do seem to me quite important. But again, I say, you know, I'm aware that this is a field of study that requires considerably more scholarship than I can possibly provide. But I do think that probably, almost certainly, that the intersection between the exiles, the Babylonian exiles, and Cyrus the Great, and the god that he worships, and then that the Persian kings worship, is clearly in some way that it's very difficult to pin down, quite important. And I think the evidence for that lies both in the clear parallels between Persian and Jewish practices and understanding of God, but also the huge significance that Cyrus has in Isaiah.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we were texting before a little bit, you mentioned that when I was reading In the Shadow of the Sword, you mentioned that your some of your thoughts had changed since putting out that book. And I know that when you write a book, it kind of goes out there, and you're sort of stuck with it out there. What were you referring to? How did Dominion sort of change your perspective on your previous book?
It was chiefly on the theme of the idea of religion. So in Shadow of the Sword, I use religion, and I use the words Judaism and Islam as though they're unproblematic, as though there's something called Judaism, there is something called Islam, there is something called Christianity. These are religions. It's like saying that, you know, a Labrador or a poodle is a kind of dog. The definitions are clear, everyone accepts them, they're not an issue. I even as I was writing the book, I came to think that actually I was applying Christian assumptions to the category of Islam and the category of Judaism. And by the end of the book, I was worried by this and thought, this is something that I want to pursue further. I want to look at, you know, what do I mean by religion? Because I'd already decided that I couldn't use the word religion to describe whatever it was that the Greeks and the Romans were doing. But I thought, Judaism, Christianity, this is the line of descent. But I changed my mind over that, even as I was kind of writing it. And certainly by the time I came to Dominion, I was pretty confident that actually the category of religion is yet another example of the way in which we are all so Christian. It's so impregnated our very language that it's only with some effort that you can begin to appreciate that. So I would now want to make what in the Shadow of the Sword I call Judaism and Islam even more distant and strange and unfamiliar, because I think that in a way Jews and Muslims have been in a sense Christianized by the sheer hegemonic force of Westernization, which in itself is a form of Christianization to a degree that almost none of us realize. I think that makes the study of the kind of prehistory of what it is that people are believing and thinking about the relationship of the human and the divine before the 18th century very, very difficult, very difficult.
I don't know how familiar you are with the name Owen Barfield.
Yes, yeah.
He was a friend of C.S. Lewis, had some very interesting ideas on what he would call the evolution of consciousness, has sort of these three phases of initial participation and then sort of a separation from participation and then a final participation. You know, for example, this, as I've delved into Barfield's work over the last couple of years a little bit, you know, one of the things that you see, and again, I think part of the reason your work caught my imagination was very much this question of religion, that as it very much has to deal with secularity and yeah. and the development of secularity. But what you find if you're attuned to these movements is that these things have come around in different forms in many different ways. This sort of a deconstructing of things. You know, you see it in the Protestant Reformation. The Protestant reformers have a deal of skepticism with respect to, let's say, the Eucharist and the host, and is its efficacious nature in and of itself in terms of how that moves the world. The power of, let's say, the papacy to have the keys over number of years that one might spend in purgatory. You know, that's in a sense a separation from participation. And whereas, let's say, in original participation, the sacrifices that one effects and how these move the gods and how these move the world, you know, for us reading back into them, we might see, you know, the Pharaoh's magicians in the book of Exodus, we might see the oracles surrounding Greek and Roman emperors and kings as, well, this is their religion that's separate from mobilizing their armies, so on and so forth. But quite obviously, they didn't have that word. They didn't have that category. This was, in fact, how the world works. The temples...
Yeah, it's completely interfused.
That's right.
Completely interfused.
That's right. And so then again, and what you find is that these separations occur. And you can even read this in Jesus, for example, after I left, I grew up, my father was a pastor, went to Christian college, you go to college, and now you're a little bit free from the parents. It's like, oh, I can decide whether or not I want to be a Christian. I thought, well, let me give the New Testament a good read with my own new college eyes. And I begin to note that so many of Jesus' conversations have to deal with, and conflicts have to deal with things like whether he heals people on the Sabbath. And, you know, Jesus couldn't wait till a Monday to, you know, let this paralytic walk. But obviously Jesus is pushing their buttons. And Jesus says things like, it's not what goes into your mouth that makes you unclean. It's sort of what's in your heart. And you begin to notice this, these things sort of separate. And in this other sphere, you have sort of a religion developing, and then they seem to keep going back and forth, coming together. So in the Protestant Reformation, well, you know, big discussion about how to think about this Eucharist, but other things now in increasingly, you know, urbanized Europe, that it's the assumption, it's the regard that I have in my heart towards God, which is a faith that counts, rather than my participation in the sacramental system, which the Roman Catholic Church has been working on for the last number of centuries. And, you know, you see this in a sense in a religiously pluralistic, polytheistic system in the ancient world, but there's no question amongst them that these things matter, and that your relationship with the God is of at least as much concern as the number of troops that you can put on the field.
I think there is something completely distinctive about Christianity that no other way of understanding humanity's relationship to the divine has really made central to itself. So if you look at what Christians come to call polytheists, the idea that you know, the Romans, for instance, had gods for everything. Notoriously, they had gods for door hinges. Right. There was nothing in the Roman world that wasn't in some way governed by the divine. And so it's not just that the gods are present in springs and trees and roads and even cities. It's also that they are kind of the equivalent of insurance companies. Everything you know, just as we take out insurance. So the Romans had religiones, religio, a bond, which you pay a god, and then the god will look after you. So so whether you're, you know, a businessman or a soldier or obviously an emperor, everything you do is done in the context of your relationship with the god. The god is looking over you. If things go wrong, it's because you haven't paid the god enough religiones. If it goes well, it's because you have. There is a sense in which the divine and the human is absolutely interfused. Now, if you look at the Jews and then Islam as it emerges, of course, the Jews do not accept that there are gods everywhere. Neither, of course, do the Muslims. There is only the one God. But that one God has given a framework of law that enables his holiness, his presence on the earth to be everywhere. So whatever you wear, whatever you eat, whatever you do, the rhythm of your life, that God is everywhere. And the fact that he is enthroned, you know, up on the heavens, far distant from the springs and the trees that people in their folly had previously worshipped, doesn't alter the fact that if you are obedient to Torah, if you are, you know, if you pay attention to the Sunnah, you are going to lead a life in which every aspect of your life is governed by a sense of the divine. Christianity goes on a different course, and it's one that evolves over the 2,000 years of its existence. And it's manifest right from the beginning. There are little acorns scattered around the New Testament. So the most obviously in the account of how Jesus is asked, should we pay taxes to the Romans? And he, of course, famously asks for a coin. And there on the coin is the head of Caesar. And so he says, render unto Caesar what is Caesar, render unto God what is God's. And this sense of a tension between the kingdom of heaven and the kingdom of earth, which is Caesar's kingdom, is a dynamic that's there throughout the New Testament and throughout the early emergence of the church. And there's a sense in which Christianity emerges with a consciousness of itself as a parody of the Augustan cult, of the Roman Empire. And it's in the parody, it's in the blasphemy that true holiness is to be found. Christ is a blasphemous parody of Augustus. If you are a Roman, that is why he is the figure of Christ is so shocking. And it's why Paul has a sense of himself as such a kind of countercultural subversive figure. He's not just reevaluating the Jewish understanding of scripture. He's also creating a blasphemous parody of the worship of Caesar. And so that sense of there being two kingdoms, two cities, the city of God and the city of man, is one that Constantine and his successors will obviously have to negotiate. And then in 410, when the city of Rome itself is sacked, and you get people saying, people who've not accepted Christianity, saying, this is what comes of abandoning the religiones. We, you know, the gods are offended. It's what then precipitates the single most influential work of theology ever written in Latin, which of course is Augustine's City of God. And Augustine's argument is a refinement of this idea that is absolutely implicit in the New Testament, the idea that there are two kingdoms, the kingdom of heaven and earthly kingdoms. And those who are in the earthly kingdom belong to the dimension of the saeculum. And the saeculum is the limit of human memory, which could be 80 years, could be 120 years, but generally is held to be 100 years, which is why in due course in French, siècle will become a century, siglo in Spanish. And this idea that there is a dimension of the saeculum which is a dimension of flux. It's like the river of time on which leaves are born, you see them fleetingly, and then they're borne away on currents, never to be seen again. And if that's true of individual human beings, then it is also true of kingdoms and of empires and even of Rome. And this is what Augustine teaches. Rome itself is a thing of the saeculum. It is a city of man, and therefore it will be borne away. And our only hope of eternity, the only hope of redeeming ourselves from this flux, from this great river, is the rope ladder that the church can provide, which is the religio, the bond that will join us to the eternity of heaven. And this gets institutionalized in the Latin half of what had been the Roman Empire because the Roman Empire collapses. In the Eastern half, it doesn't. And so over the course of the centuries that follow the collapse of Rome's empire in the West, you start to get a sense that is completely distinctive to that outermost, westernmost fringe of Eurasia that you get nowhere else, which is that earthly rulers, earthly autocrats, are not complicit in the dimension of the eternal in the way that they are in Constantinople or Baghdad, or the cities of India or China or Japan, that they should back off. And in the 11th century, this conviction becomes strong enough to initiate what effectively is Europe's first revolution, this great project of reformatio, of reformatting, of remaking society in the way that an individual Christian is remade and reborn when he's baptized or she is baptized. So the ambition in the 11th century is to remake, to rebirth Christendom. And that requires kings no longer to have a stake in the supernatural. They can no longer appoint bishops. They have to be humbled in the snow, to be whipped through the streets of their own cities if they offend. And the result of that is that this radical sense of a separate, of two dimensions, a dimension of the saeculum, and then a dimension of the church, which provides the religio, beds down over the course of the centuries that follow the 11th century. And by the time you get the Reformation, the second, it's the Reformation, we call it, but it's just a second bout of reformatio, another great convulsion. Things change with the Reformation, but the idea that there is a dimension of the saeculum and a dimension of religio doesn't. Of course, the understanding of religio does change because in the Middle Ages, religio is the particular property of those who are particularly concerned with it, monks, nuns, hermits, whatever. But there are no monks, there are no friars in Protestant Europe. So everyone has a religio. And that bond, what is the individual bond that a Protestant has with God? That becomes the great center, the idea that it's about your personal belief, your personal relationship, whether you personally have grace, whether you personally reading the scriptures, the Spirit descends on you. And so it becomes much more personalized, even as it's it's being kind of increasingly shunted to the side of what is coming to be defined not as the cyclum, but as the secular. And if you like, the cyclum has been secularized. The concept of the secular no longer has the kind of theological context that Augustine had given it. And instead, you're starting to get the idea, the more that Protestants come to think that religion is something personal, so the more the sense of the divine can be bled out of the rest of society. And so by the 18th century, you come to have this idea, which is entirely distinctive to Western Europe and of course, to the various states that are being planted in continents beyond Europe, including the United States. This idea that you have a dimension called the secular, which is separate from something called religion. And Europeans, when they go to the world of Islam, the world of India, China, whatever, export that understanding. And it's something that we have imposed on the rest of the world, and the rest of the world has so internalized it that Jews and Muslims and Hindus and Buddhists can all think of themselves as belonging to things called religions, and think of religion as something that exists separate from society. And it can't be emphasized how weird and distinctive and idiosyncratic a way of understanding the world that is. And a huge amount of I think, of what's happening in the world at the moment is a kind of kickback against that from people who are not of Christian backgrounds. So I think it's, in a way, I mean, I think it's a huge part of what explains Zionism. And Zionism is an attempt to reverse the status of Jews as people who have a religion. They want to go back to being a people. They want to go back to being the people of Israel. I think that variously, Erdogan's rejection of Ataturk secularism and the kind of bloodthirsty literalism of Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State are both, in their very different ways, responses to a sense that Islam has kind of been Christianized. It's kind of become a religion, which it never was before. And likewise, I think that what's happening in India with Modi is his promotion of Hindutva, his promotion of the idea that India is properly Hindu, is a rejection of the idea that the founding fathers of the Indian Republic, who were all educated in English and therefore with British political and sociological assumptions, they had imported this British concept of the secular, and now Modi wants to get rid of it. And I think that part of the convulsions that are roiling the world at the moment is a reflection of the fact that Western power is retreating, and therefore the categories that the West in its heyday in the 19th and 20th centuries had exported is now kind of coming to seem more shadowy. And the problem that we have in the West is that we don't understand how contingent, how culturally bred these categories are, and how fundamentally Christian they are. Well, that's a long answer. Sorry.
No, it's a great answer. You could have got another 5-10 minutes. I agree.
But also, you see, the problem, and this goes back to why I've changed my mind about In the Shadow of the Sword, is that we back project it as well. So we back project these categories. So if you get a children's book on ancient Greece, or you know, or even an adult book on ancient Greece, you'll have categories on the economy, on warfare, on women, and one on religion. And you'll have a chapter about the Greek gods and sacrifices, and then you'll move on to stuff about battleships. But only someone bred of Christian culture could write that kind of book. only Christians and people influenced by Christianity could talk about ancient Egyptian religion in the same way that they could assume that Judaism was a religion. It's the same thing. We and it's what humans always do. We have a distinctive way of seeing the world. We don't recognize that it's distinctive because we're like goldfish. Goldfish don't realize that they're goldfish. We don't realize that we, as you know, living in the secular world that we do, are deeply Christian.
Well, and you know what we've been. Oh, there's so much here. So there's so one of the people that I've been having conversations with on my channel is John Vervaeke, who is a scholar out of the University of Toronto, and he, like many, talk about the fact that, well, in sort of a post-Christian context, we need to get away from these two worlds mythology. And whereas you can look at, you know, the talk about the Axial Age, you can look at various two worlds mythology coming, you know, out of the ancient world. You can look at Platonism, for example. And even when we began our conversation, when you're talking about the Greek historians, we can't trust them. We're working with this question about how.
It's not that we can't trust them.
But trust them for what is exactly the question?
Yeah, it's that their understanding of truth is different to ours, perhaps.
Right. And why is that? Because, and I, so in your Dellingpod conversation, which I thought was, you know, he says at the end of it, this is the best conversation you'll have. And sometimes I've listened to a whole bunch of them.
He says that to all the guys.
But it was a very good one. The, you know, so what happens then with obviously the rise of Hitler and the Nazis, Nazism is a radical. I always wondered, okay, why did the Nazis hate the Jews? And after I listened to you, this set me on a whole nother reading binge of, you know, what was really behind the Nazis? And this vision of post-Darwin, we're going to strip off all of the, you know, all of the intellectual stuff. And in some ways, they look back and say, you know, with Nietzsche, well, you know, the Jews sent us on this track. And so we're going to look at the most successful people in the world, and they're the Germans because we have to disregard the Jews. And so what gets manifest is simply Darwin, that power in and of itself is what we must do. And so if you look at, let's say, the work of Timothy Snyder, who says, you know, the Nazis wanted to get rid of states because states impose this unnatural layer upon us whereby, you know, going back to Nietzsche, we'd have all this craziness such as we should have regard for the weak and the strong should just simply rise. And so there's this big question right now of, okay, so if not Christianity that sort of sets the thought world for all of our material movements, what then?
Well, I think there's more to you know, there's kind of a really grotesquely horrible paradox at the heart of why the Nazis persecute the Jews. Because, of course, the Nazis believe that strength should triumph over weakness, and they believe that strength should properly be vested in the idea of race rather than of nation. Absolutely. But they are aware that it's a struggle between different races, all of whom have different strengths. And Hitler in particular, when he looks back at the classical world, which of course he greatly admires, its glamour, its swagger, its strength, its power, its beauty, its charisma. And he looks at the Parthenon or he looks at the Colosseum and he sees now nothing but rubble. And he says, well, what went wrong? And his answer is that, the Jews, who are a kind, you know, they have a cancerous cosmopolitanism. So it's kind of the reverse of what we might think, that the Jews regard themselves as a distinctive people. To Hitler, actually, the danger is precisely that the Jews preach a kind of cosmopolitanism, and on top of that, they preach a concern for the weak, and they do this as a way of bringing down the strong. So it's a kind of cod Nietzscheanism. And the person who best exemplifies this, who is most devastating in the consequences of his teachings, is the Jew Paul, as Hitler describes him. Because what Paul combines is a cosmopolitan conviction that there is no Jew or Greek, and a sinister regard that there is no slave or free. Indeed, that there is no man or woman, and that this conflation, this is a kind of poison, a radioactivity that will slowly poison the beautiful strength of the Greeks and the Romans. And that therefore it's the Jews in the form of Paul and the Christianity that he's preached that brings classical civilization down. And the risk therefore for Hitler, if he's to have a Reich that he wants to last for 1,000 years, is that if the Jews are left, then they will produce another Paul. And so the grotesque paradox that I mentioned is that Hitler targets the Jews because he blames them for Christianity, even as he is able to invoke traditions of Christian anti-Semitism to do it. So it's a kind of horrifying no-win situation for the Jews. You know, to be targeted for being Jewish is bad enough, but to be targeted for being Christian is a kind of a horrible insult.
Yes, that's indeed. So, and I love how you laid out the, you know, we might say that this is post-colonialism, you know, continuing to follow, you know, to follow its path, in Turkey, in the Islamic world, in Hindu, in India. Where do they go? Because, you know, do they try to remine their, I mean, especially, and I could see why, for example, some of the questions that you raised about the origin mythos of Islam become particularly disturbing when, you know, and I found the, you know, the BBC documentary that you did also quite interesting and compelling, because in a sense what this leads to is a sort of state polytheism where separate peoples try different mythical overlays, and we see which ones triumph over others. That's a rather scary new world, as opposed to sort of a multinational Christian empire that one might argue the 20th century sort of had.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what will happen. And I don't know. I mean, really, the question is how Christianized have these traditions become? And is it possible to de-Christianize them? And, you know, a lot of the projects that are going on in various parts of the world are attempts to explore that. And it's hard to know where they will go. But I mean, adding to that is that we too in the West are embroiled in something rather similar, because it does seem to me that that one of the kind of unsettling implications of the emergence of the idea of the secular and the idea of religions as things that are kind of at a margin is that in a way atheism is a kind of logical endpoint, because ultimately everything gets so drained of the sacral that everything ends up secular. And that does seem to me a challenge for Christians to face, which is that in a sense the great campaign, which is there right from the beginning, of bringing people who've walked in darkness into light, and toppling idols and banishing superstition, which in turn is something that goes back to the Old Testament prophets and to Elijah and the priests of Baal and all that kind of stuff. And which leads, you know, Saint Martin and Boniface and so on to go into woods and to chop down the trees of Thor and to consecrate springs and all this kind of thing. And then in the Reformation inspires Protestant reformers to condemn the Catholic Church as being a sump of paganism, and to kind of again topple idols and smash statues of Madonnas and things like that, and to talk about discovering the light. And then that in turn feeds into the Enlightenment project, which then turns on Christianity itself And there's a sense in now in which, you know, is there anything left? Any, you know, is it, how, so the challenge that Jews or Muslims or Hindus face in kind of de-Christianizing their understanding of the world is paralleled by the challenge that Christians face, which is in a way to re-sacralize their world. Is it possible for people, say, from a radically Protestant background, what do they do with angels? What do they do with places where miracles happened? What do they do with this kind of vast inheritance of the mysterious and the supernatural and the miraculous, which has to be a part of any Christian faith, I would have thought, really, because otherwise, what are you saying about the Bible, that none of this happened? And that's why it seems that Christianity is so much more vital in somewhere like Africa, because in Africa, it's much easier to believe this kind of stuff. Spirits are much more kind of manifest. Whereas in the West, I don't know. Lots of Christians that I know seem incredibly embarrassed by you know, talk of angels or the, you know, miracles or anything like that. And yet, I do think that without a kind of resurrection of, as it were, of those kind of dimensions, right. I don't really see that Christianity as it's been understood for the past 2,000 years really has a future. It clearly has a future diffused into kind of liberalism or secularism or whatever, that kind of dimension in which its ethics and its morals have been so internalized that people just take them for granted. But as the expression of something profoundly mysterious, the idea that there is a one creator God who's fashioned humans in his image and who came down and was tortured to death on a cross and rose from the dead, and, you know, this great miraculous fulcrum around which everything organizes, much harder, I think, to continue to believe in that if the entire world is completely drained of a sense of the miraculous and the strange and the weird.
I don't know as a pastor what
you think about that.
Well,
I mean, that's maybe I speak as someone living in England, which is that much less godly than America. I don't know.
Well, these are many of the, I didn't start doing YouTube because I said, oh, I have all this extra time, I'm going to blabber on the internet for 2 hours a day. I started this because I noticed the work of Jordan Peterson, and I noticed, and what caught my attention about his work was not the fuss about pronouns so much, but which is interesting in terms of this question about materiality. Am I male by virtue of I have an XY chromosome, so on and so forth. But what I noticed was that men basically between the ages of 25 and 45 who had checked out of Christianity, usually in their teens, were, after listening to hours of him ramble about the Bible through evolutionary psychology and Jungian archetypes and all of this, began to want to go to church again. And I had been, you know, as a Christian minister, watching a good number of people walking away from the faith over the last, you know, 20, 30 years of my ministry. And for the first time, what I had seen as a one-way street, suddenly people were coming back down the same road. And I said, well, what's...
So I have to admit that I don't really know anything about Jordan Peterson, apart from an interview he did over here with a Channel 4 interviewer. And there's something about lobsters or something.
Yes, yes.
But beyond that, I've never read him or watched him. So, but I know that he's a kind of been a big deal. But what is it about him that is...
Well, that's exactly what I wanted to know.
He's kind of reintroducing his sense of the weird, is he?
It's exactly why this guy whose relationship to the church, people who had been having, let's call it nihilistic anxiety and depression after watching hours of his video, would find relief. And they're ongoing.
He was depressing them so badly were rushing to church to escape it.
He was telling people all sorts of things that any mother would have told them. Clean your room. Don't just date and have sex with this girl. Marry her. this entire movement of men who had very much been post-Christian and depressed were finding themselves with renewed interest in the Bible, renewed vigor in terms of taking responsibility for their lives, and then of all things going to church, and of all churches often, Orthodox and Roman Catholic churches. And it, you know, the more I dug into this, so as a Christian minister who has a dramatically empty sanctuary, I wondered why people were paying 40 bucks a pop to watch him lecture and ramble for 2 hours about the Bible, were so interested in this guy and what was happening as a result of it. And this led me then down questions about many of the issues that you have been looking at and essentially wrestling with an idea which a number of people have been wrestling with over the last 100 years of sort of a meaning crisis in the West. And you see that as, you know, why is it that young men who had already made it to the UK or France or the United States, who had the opportunity in comparison to people living in Gaza or the West Bank or Syria or Iran, now suddenly wish to, you know, I'm going to go and fight for ISIS. You know, what's that about? The contemporary Western trajectory is, well, we're animals, and once we sort of have our needs met, you know, we'll be fine, and why would we want to risk all of that to go fight for an Islamic State in the middle of the desert? That, of course, was something happening to many of the heirs of Islam, but what's happening to many of the heirs of Christianity, leading people to imagine that, you know, as Dostoevsky and Tolstoy noted, you know, once we have sufficient food and bread and we have all of our appetites met, what then is there to live for? And, you know, you who've spent a fair amount of work in late antiquity, I was reading Robin Fox's book on Augustine a number of years ago and trying to get a sense of, you know, why of all things do you have in late antiquity parents pulling their hairs out because their daughters now suddenly wish to be virgins forever? You know, and these are not children of the poor, these are children of the wealthy, that we are strange animals and that we need a mythos to inhabit. Oh,
I mean, on that, it's because, you know, it's because of Paul, really. The whole idea of Paul as this kind of blue meanie who turns up wagging his finger and ruining everybody's fun. Everyone's having great sex and then up he pops and, oh no, it's like a cold shower. Couldn't be more unfair, because why are girls embracing virginity? Because they can. And that's what Christianity gives, because what Christianity gives to women is a sense that their bodies are sacred and that they've been created in the image of God. And indeed, Paul says, of course, you know, Paul is all of, it's the love of Christ for his people, for his church, that has, you know, is the great fulcrum around which everything is organized. And so therefore, if a man and a woman are to live together, then that must be what it modeled on them. Christ as the image of the man and the church as the image of the woman. And that gives, in the context of Roman understandings about sexuality, an unbelievable dignity to both, but an enormous pressure on the man, because in Rome, the binary is not male or female. It's the free male citizen and everybody else. And the free male citizen is perfectly entitled to do whatever he needs to do to get rid of his seminal fluid in any orifice of any inferior in his household that he likes, male or female, it doesn't make any difference what their age are. He can do whatever he likes to them. And this is the assumption about sexuality of a society in which the gods are all rapists. All the gods rape. That's what they do. And so Roman men rape. And to be a non-male citizen in the Roman world is constantly to be at the risk of rape, and a world in which no one has any problem with this whatsoever. And so what Paul introduces to men, you are like Christ, therefore you can't go around, you know, sodomizing the page boy or raping the scullery maid. You just can't do that. That's not what Jesus would do. You know, what would Jesus do? He certainly wouldn't do that. And to women, he's saying your bodies are sacred. You know, you men do not have the right to just jump you and use you and abuse you. And of course, this is demanding. I mean, you know, really demanding on men who just kind of assume that they can do what they like, but demanding on women as well, because of course it you know, it requires a kind of consecration to the idea of the holy that in its own ways is demanding. But that's what underlies this unbelievable reconfiguring of sexual roles and the understanding of sex that kind of eats like an acid through the traditional Roman understanding of sex, and which, you know, we are still the heirs to. And that's what the Me Too movement demonstrates, that the entire sexual revolution of the 60s, which kind of idolized and enshrined figures like Dionysus, the Dionysic, the figure of the rock star, having sex with as many underage groupies as he possibly could. Actually, we're still sufficiently Christian, all of us, progressives, as well as believing Christians, that we don't want that world. And the Me Too movement wouldn't work unless men as well as women basically subscribe to a fundamentally Pauline understanding of what proper sexual relations should be. But again, does that understanding of sexual roles, can it survive without the theology that underpinned it? And there's a sense in which wokeness is a kind of hectoring without any theological strength behind it, which is why I think so many people find it shrill, that it doesn't come with a sense of you know, this remarkable sense of the way in which a human's body is hardwired into an understanding of the divine and the supernatural that goes back to the creation. And that's the power that I think Christians, as well as those who are not Christians, have lost, because Christianity in the West has kind of bled itself of that sense.
I think throughout the ancient world, there are many different schemes of saying no to one's passions and one's appetites. And you'll find various religious things. What tends to, let me lay out this for you. I think what actually propels and compels people is, in some sense, a higher golden vision towards which people aspire. And in the wake of that, laws and rules regarding appetites form. And so, for example, you know, Pauline restrictions, comments to the Corinthians about, you know, you ought not to lie with prostitutes, you know, the kinds of things Paul is trying to nuance with the Corinthians. All of that is in the service of, there's this vision, which is of Christ himself and of aspiring to become such a thing. It's in that wake that these sexual ethics and all of these actionable life rules are created, because the vision, of course, I mean, what you said earlier in the conversation, which was this this blasphemous parody of the worship of Caesar, of course, you know, Paul says to the Corinthians, it's Christ crucified, which is, you know, foolishness to the Greeks, because, you know, here, and which I think is, you know, at the heart of your book. So here is this, how can the vision of this one, the Son of Man, which of course from Daniel 7 is this imperial hero who inherits a universal kingdom for all, for everlasting, he is the one who goes to the cross. And so what energizes the West and energizes, you know, it wasn't just that, you know, oh, somehow celibacy is hotness because, you know, we've sort of sexed ourselves out. That's certainly some of it. But there's a vision out there that compels people to undergo the sacrifices. That vision can somehow be lost, and in successive generations, some of the habits which have generally been healthy and made sense at other levels sort of get maintained. But I think your basic thesis is correct, that once that vision is lost of the thing to which we strive, the it's just a matter of time when the rest of the scaffolding goes away.
I mean, I'm talking personally here. I'm not.
I believe you are
talking. Giving a kind of cool, measured analysis of Christian history, which is what I try to do in Dominion. Speaking personally, what I found in researching the book, the more I read it, the more kind of animating I found it, was a sense of how kind of radiantly potent Christian theology was. And it's not surprising that I should have done, because of course, this is the most successful way for explaining humanity's relationship to the universe that has ever been devised. And it's been framed by some of the greatest philosophers and artists and poets. And what I felt was that things that I had been taught as a child at church, the things you had to do, I'd just been told why you had to do them as rules. And I kind of respect them. I'm sufficiently the child of my childhood that I tend to live by them. But I didn't have a real sense of why, what the kind of impulses were for these ways of seeing it. And therefore I didn't really have a sense of how strange they were and how distinctive and how contingent. And the more I kind of washed myself in the radiance of this astonishing tradition, this astonishing way of seeing the world, the more these assumptions came to life for me. And I think that's both a challenge and an opportunity for people who want to teach that this is all true, who want to say this is all absolutely true, because in a way, we're simultaneously too familiar with the Christian story, and so we've become anaesthetized to the sense of the weirdness of it. But at the same time, we've bled it of a sense of the strangeness. So it's simultaneously, we've lost the sense it's familiar to us, but at the same time, we've lost the sense of we don't really understand it. It's simultaneously familiar and strange. And this is why I found writing the book such a kind of transfigurative personal experience, was that I found, now I understand stuff. And the more I look at it, and it's not like it's all kind of a positive. There are kind of incredible, it's kind of quite frightening as well, a lot of it. But I think that's also part of my understanding, is that actually the kind of Jesus meek and mild stuff, the idea that God is nice, the idea that Jesus was nice, is really kind of inadequate to the complexity of it all, and the ferocity of it all, and the challenge of it all, and therefore the poetry and the majesty and the mystery of it all. And it kind of, I'm still very much in the process of synthesizing all this. But the sense of the power of it, I kind of warm my hands at it. And what can I say? I mean, it's a bit like getting your first Apple product and you don't quite know how to use it. And then you start to work out how to use it. And then you discover there's all this other stuff and you wire it in. And before you know it, you're completely hardwired into it. And you had no idea how on earth you functioned without it. Yeah. Because it's all designed to cohere. Yeah. Am I being blasphemous in saying that there's a kind of parallel? Once you start buying into the fundamentals, the principles, then you discover that more and more and more of it makes sense. However, equally, there is the challenge that there are so many different ways of making sense of it, that you can never rest content with the idea that there is one single way. So that seems to be the problem. And I mean, it's kind of interesting you saying that people, when they go back to church, go back to Catholicism or to Orthodoxy, because I do think that, you know, speaking as someone raised in a Protestant tradition, Protestantism is, I think, part of the problem. I think that, you know, there's much that I find kind of the emergence of Protestantism, I find that the Puritans, people who traditionally I've been kind of taught to despise, I find them very, very inspiring. And, you know, I find their, the kind of honesty, the kind of spiritual integrity of it so moving and powerful. I find the idea of Bunyan the Pilgrim's Progress incredibly moving and powerful. I find it all very powerful. But at the same time, I feel that there's a kind of almost a dare I say graceless gracelessness, perhaps not the emojis, but the and again going back to this idea that I was saying earlier, that there has to be a sense of the mystery, and perhaps that's what you get with the Catholic and the Orthodox churches that you don't get with the spare, ornate, strip cleaned Protestantism. That in a sense it's Protestantism has been so stripped of a sense of mystery that you might as well go the full Dawkins. Why not?
Well,
I don't know if that makes sense.
No, it makes perfect sense. And I mean, I was struck by your book because I'd been watching the debates. Of course, you know, same-sex marriage is something that's just, you know, going into Protestant denominations all over the place and people having to work these things out. And I very quickly saw this is a Christendom civil war, that there are yeah, competing aspects of Christianity that are at play in these questions.
Yeah.
But I think when you know, it's not accidental that right at the center of the Protestant Reformation was the question of what are we doing when we gather around this table in obedience, take my body, drink my blood. What on earth does that mean? And why does that connect out with the rest of our lives? You know, I was touched at the end of Dominion, you know, talking about your aunt. And you know, Leslie Newbegin, who I think is, you know, these issues, if you know where to look, people have been playing with these issues for quite a while now, because they are not new, and they all, these things happen. But, you know, the church is the hermeneutic of the gospel. And in many ways, you know, in a sense, what you saw in the love of your aunt is this vision of that there's something powerful there in that sacrificial grace-filled love that obviously one finds enormously compelling and beautiful and intriguing enough to pay way too much money for last year's hardware, which you'll get from Apple, but in a really nice package.
I mean, I have to say, the idea of the kind of Pentecostal spirit, the idea of Pentecostal fire, the idea of people being illumined and being sufficiently illumined that they suddenly decide slavery has to be abolished, for instance. I mean, it seems it's an incredibly powerful instinct. And I watch from a distance with fascination Pentecostalism. It doesn't really feature in Dominion, but I'm very interested in it, and I'm partly interested in it because, in a way, it's with Islamic radicalism, it's the great convulsive, transformative spiritual force at work in the world at the moment. But for all the attention Islamic radicalism gets, Pentecostalism gets nothing. But it's kind of burning away under the surface. So you know, I'm really interested in that. But counter to that, I'm just too undemonstrative and embarrassable to have anything to do with it. We have a ruach just up the hill from where I live, and I've gone there a couple of times, and I just feel so embarrassed. And everybody is swaying and dancing and speaking, and I sit there rigid with embarrassment, and I just can't surrender to it. But equally, in terms of kind of discovering a sense of the strange and the beautiful, I've basically gone to the opposite extreme, which is over the course of writing Dominion, I went to a number of churches that I hoped would give me a bit of flavoring, because I wanted to be respectful of the beliefs and the convictions of the people that I was writing about. So I would try to find churches that kind of mapped onto, you know, Lutheran, I was writing about Luther, go to a Lutheran church and Reformed churches and so on. It brought me to go to the oldest church in London, which is called St. Bartholomew the Great. There's also St. Bartholomew the Lesser. And it was founded by a man who was supposedly Henry I's jester, who went to Rome and prayed to be healed, and vowed that he would go back and found a hospital and a priory if he did, and he duly did. So he went back to London and he founded St. Bartholomew's Hospital, which still stands to this day, and he founded these two churches. And the church was then, at the Reformation, was stripped, the priory was closed down. And in due course, what had been the Lady Chapel was turned into a printer's. And among the people who worked in that printer's was Benjamin Franklin. So you have almost the entire history of Dominion. You have, you know, the papal revolution, you have the medieval church, you have the Reformation, you have the Enlightenment. But the church goes, and it's a kind of fusion of the medieval and the High Anglican. So you have incense, you have the Angelus, you have the Lady Chapel has been restored. Equally, you have the King James Bible, you have the Book of Common Prayer, you have Reformed theology. And it's just fantastic. And wow. It gives me a sense of the kind of beauty and the strangeness and the poetry of it. So I think that's for me rather than the Ruach. But I can kind of feel the power of the Ruach as well.
Yeah. Well, Pentecostalism is basically a culture slide along all of these issues. It's a denial of modernity. And, you know, modernists are trying to have apologetics to argue things in modernity to prove this and that. Pentecostals just say, you know, be filled with the Spirit. Yes. So
there's an incredible power there, I think.
There is. Well, that is, in fact, as you say, that is the power. That is the reason it doesn't get any attention like Islamic fundamentalism, is because they are more or less in alignment with the moral, you know, the moral landscape that the West has been in. And so it goes under the radar.
Yeah.
So what are you, I know, I've got to let you go. What kinds of things are you thinking about in terms of the future for working on? Because these things are not accidental.
Well, I, at the moment, I've gone right back to my roots, and I'm translating Suetonius's 12 Lives of the Caesars for Penguin Classics, which will replace Robert Graves's. So I'm doing it purely for the bragging rights. But of course, and then after this, I've done Rubicon, who you mentioned, that I did a book called Dynasty about the Julia Claudians, and the next book I'm doing after this is about the heyday of the Roman Empire. So it's called Pax, but it will be a slightly ironic title because it's bookended by the Titus's sack of Jerusalem and then Hadrian's war against the Jews. But this is, you know, this is the world of the Colosseum and of Hadrian's Wall and of Pompeii. So I've got all that to come. And my ambition ultimately is to write an entire history of the fall of the rise and fall of the Roman Empire that will end with the depopulation of Rome in the 6th century. So there's a moment when there's a siege and the whole of Rome is depopulated, and that seems to me a good end point. But of course, it will also effectively be a history of the coming of Christianity, because you probably won't remember, but in Rubicon there is there's some lines of Virgil from the fourth eclogue, which describes how a child will be born and bring a reign of peace, and Virgil name checks a virgin. And this was celebrated by Christians both in antiquity and through the Middle Ages as a prophecy of Christ. And they are very strange verses, and I remember including them in Rubicon as a prefiguring of what was to come. Talking about the peace that Augustus brings to the Roman world, I wanted to include them as a kind of a nudge and a wink that, you know, we know what's coming. And then in Dynasty, again, the Christians feature. We're seeing it through the eyes. They're seeing them through the eyes of Nero, who is blaming them for the fire of Rome, and they're weird Jewish cultists, and that's all they are. And then in the next one, the next book, they will appear when Pliny the Younger meets them and writes to the Emperor Trajan to ask what he should be doing with them. And so it will go on. But once I've done that, my ambition is kind of to follow through some of the issues that I've left hanging in Dominion, and to look at the 60s in particular as the equivalent of the first decade of the Reformation. I think that in time, people will come to see the 60s as having an analogous significance. I think that it's generated a great convulsive process of moral and ethical churn that is absolutely on a level with the Reformation. So I want to look at it in those terms, which I don't think anyone has really done before. People have written histories of the 60s, but I don't think they've put them quite in that context. So that's what I'd like to do, because I felt particularly by the time I was getting to the stuff about the 60s and the aftermath that I was just kind of scratching the surface, really. There's so much to write about, and my sense of it's changing all the time as as the years turn by and our that's the fascinating part. One of the fascinations of history is this kaleidoscopic effect that the past changes. It's not just the future that is open and unstable. It's the past as well. And our understanding of the past is constantly changing depending on how the future is developing. And I think that seems to me clearly true of the 60s.
Well, I'll very much look forward to that book. I thought your chapter on the 60s, I thought that chapter was a masterpiece. I thought it was tremendous. I loved how you wove it through, and I've very much benefited from your work, and with great excitement, I'll look forward to your new projects coming out and continue to use your work and talk about your work and in my own project. So I'm deeply grateful.
Thank you very much for your support, which has meant a great deal to me over the past few months. Because it is a kind of terra incognita for me, the world of contemporary Christianity. Mm. And people have been very, very welcoming and very encouraging and very kind. So I'm very grateful for that.
Well, thank you much, and I will let you. It's evening already for you, so
I'm just gonna make supper.
So thank you very much, and I'll probably post this tomorrow morning in California time, and I'll send you the link. And once again, keep doing what you're doing, because I think it's helping. I don't know what your pastoral ambitions are, but I think you are helping a lot of people sort through their stuff.
I have no pastoral ambitions at all.
well, your work.
I just have ambitions to write history. But if that has pastoral I'm very happy.
But there are thousands of people going through, again, what has been called a meaning crisis. And like you say, the past does change. And we ourselves, we derive our identity in many ways from the past. And so working through these issues helps people find something to live towards. And that's no small contribution.
Well, it's lovely of you to say that. And obviously Dominion, in a way, is a kind of personal pilgrimage for me as well. It's been a process of trying to make sense of myself and the world, the society, the culture in which I live. So if other people feel similarly, then obviously I'm thrilled.
it's happening, and it'll continue. Thank you, Tom. Beautiful to talk to you.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Have a good night.